This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Jeff Rubin, Jeff Rubin Show. I am Jeff Rubin, and joining me on the Skype and the phone this week, I'm just kidding! This isn't the interview yet! This is still the introduction where I provide general updates about the status of the podcast and promote my other projects! Oh my god, I got you guys good! I wish I could see your faces! Okay, so, with this episode of the Jeff Rubin, Jeff Rubin Show, we bring this current run of episodes to an end. This is the last episode for a little while. I really liked coming back for a month and doing a month straight of episodes. It was really fun for me. Let's see, we did the summer movie podcast. We did the Buffalo Emoji. We talked about the movie Showgirls. We talked about race and gaming. And then there's still today's episode, which is a good one. So that's like a really fun little run for me. I'm really proud of it, and I hope you guys enjoyed it too. For me, this is like a good way for me to keep doing this thing I love while... in a sustainable way that just kind of jibes with the rest of my life. So I hope it worked for you guys too. Stay subscribed because I will definitely be coming back with another one. If for no other reason than just because this is, by my count, the 249th full episode of the Jeff Rubin Show. So, like, I can't leave it there. I got to come back for 250. We still have some summer movie business. We got to finish up with Pat. So... this is not the end of the show. Stay subscribed, and I'll come back with more. I hope you guys enjoyed this season of episodes as much as I did. And the other thing I got to tell you is that, of course, this episode of the Jeff Rubin, Jeff Rubin Show is brought to you by LiesGame.com. The game I made, because I thought it would be fun, where you get to make up lies and try to fool your friends. If you've made it this far into the season, I guess you probably know what the deal is. But just in case, LiesGame.com is a free game. You play with your friends. Everyone just opens up their web browser and goes to LiesGame.com. You can play it in real life. You can play it over video conference. And if you've already played it, if you've already tried it, I'm actually going to be adding some new Halloween-themed content in the coming weeks. So there'll be a little update there, something fresh if you're looking for an excuse to come back. Thank you to all the Jeff Rubin Show listeners who have tried LiesGame.com. You are, I love all the listeners, but you are my favorite listeners of all. And I think that is it. Thank you again so much. I love doing this podcast, and thank you for listening. Let's start the show for real this time. Welcome to the Jeff Rubin Show. I'm Jeff Rubin. Joining me today on the Skype-a-phone is Mark Miller, a professor of meat science and the coach of the Texas Tech meat judging team. Mark, welcome to the show.
Jeff, great to be here. Honored to be able to talk to you about meat judging and meat science with you and all of your listeners.
Perfect. And you played it very naturally, not betraying the fact I had to do that twice because I messed up the recording the first time. So... now we can actually begin recording. We can start talking about it. And I guess the first thing, I mean, very basics, is like, I think a lot of people right now are thinking, oh, like competitive meat judging, question mark? That's a thing? So you're going to have to kind of, I think, walk us through the game and the rules and the nuts and bolts of just how this competition works. So I guess, first of all, who is judging meat? Who's participating in this?
Well, pretty much every university that has a football program or a major athletic program has a meat science and meat judging team. So it would be students who are freshmen and sophomores, so it'd be 18 to 20-year-old. And they would be from Nebraska, Illinois, Kentucky, Florida, Georgia, Alabama, Texas, and Oklahoma, Kansas. So Kansas State, Oklahoma State, Texas A&M, pretty much every, Ohio State, everybody that has a major athletic program has a meat judging team. And so these students come to major in usually an agricultural field, but not necessarily always. I've had students who are engineering majors, business majors who participated on the team because they're truly competing for a national championship, just like all the athletic teams.
Are they judging Raw meat? Is it like cooked meat? What is it they're judging?
They are. They're judging raw meat, and so they are looking at beef, pork, and lamb, and they're looking at their carcasses and their cuts, and so they look at them for their quality, how well they're going to eat and taste, and then they also determine how lean and trim and how much red meat they would have as opposed to fat.
Is this something I'm less familiar than I should be with how food production works. Like, is this something that happens in general, you know, day-to-day meat production? Is there, like, someone who is kind of fulfilling this role in meat production and they're, like, kind of training to be the best they can be at that job? Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. They are training to be able to go into the industry, and they'll go to work in all the major companies like Oscar Mayer and Tyson and Cargill and JBS, which would also be Swift, Eckrich, Jimmy Dean, and then also into the USDA, into the federal government, to be able to help ensure that the food that our consumers are receiving is the safest food on the planet and in the world.
But even at a big company like that, they need someone to, like, look at the meat and gauge the meat by, I don't know, by eyeball, is that right?
That is correct. So they need to be able to look at the amount of marbling and the fat within the muscle and determine how much one has versus the other, and the one that has more is better.
Who determines what the correct answers are, like what they're supposed, what they ideally would get? Is that another group of professionals? Like, what are they ideally trying to get to?
That's a very good question. The officials come from other universities and academic institutions. They also come from the industry, people who are actually out working in the companies and who are looking to be future employers of the students that are in this program, and then also from the federal government, from the United States Department of Agriculture. So those are the officials. Those are the people who actually officiate and determine what is the best and what is the worst and how the students should be able to look at those and know how to rank them in the same way. Meat judging is governed by a national body called the American Meat Science Association. So there's staff people who actually come and run the contest and invite the officials in and put it all together in a very professional manner.
Where does the meat come from? Like, I assume the meat's all pretty decent. I don't know. Like, where is the meat actually sourced from?
The lamb carcasses source out of Colorado, and so they're transported from Colorado from Superior Farms outside of Denver. And so those will get shipped to wherever the contest is going to be.
Only from one farm? It's like all the lamb comes from one farm in all meat judging competitions?
It does. It comes from one plant that harvests from many different farms.
Okay.
So a lot of the production of lamb happens in Texas and Colorado and Wyoming and Iowa. And so it's sort of a central place where the lamb can be transported to be harvested. And then those will get transported to New York City, to Chicago, to Florida. And that's where people's lamb would come from for the majority of what they consume in the metropolitan areas of the United States.
And is there, when they're judging the meat, is there like a time pressure element where like they have less time than they'd maybe like to, you know, give it a thorough review? Or is it, I'm just trying to picture like a competition day.
So the competition begins, the students get up about 4 a.m. in the morning. Because the contest and the instructions and everything start around 6 a.m.
That's like really you can tell the legacy of farming in this competition that it begins at 6 a.m.
That is correct. And the industry does the same thing because, you know, animals being transported and moved, and that happens 24 hours, 7 days a week. Of like dairy farms, cows always need to be milked. They don't know that it's Christmas or Easter or a holiday or anything like that. And so they are always needing to be processed. And so farmers and agricultural people, whether you're working in a company or working in your own farm, are always having to work at different hours throughout the 24-hour period. And especially early in the morning, it is very important that our students are able to function, able to not miss. I mean, that's part of the big training and what we do is to try to help the students to know how to be able to operate and run very important processes throughout the entire day. Well, and a lot of plants will run for 24 hours. Pet food plants, a lot of our students will go to work to take care of your dogs and cats. That's a very important, very big science. It's you know, it takes a lot of chemistry. People wouldn't think that there's a lot of science in what we do, but we take a lot of chemistry and we apply that to how to make animals healthier and how to make people healthier. So, you know, the areas that a kid will be able to go to work and gets training in from meat judging are areas like nutrition and diet health, and also food safety, because we're always working to try to make sure that the meat that people consume is the safest and doesn't have anything that would make you sick in it.
And I don't think we ever got a clear answer on the speed element. Like, when they're doing this, do they have to like rush to do this, or do they, I just want to make sure I got that. Do they have to like, can they take their time? Like, how long do they have to inspect the carcasses?
Oh, that's a really good question. And I apologize for getting over into another area.
Not at all. No, I love that too. I just want to, I want to like, I want to really understand the game like elements of the competition.
Yeah, so the students get up early, then we go to the plant, and then they get broken into different groups. And so each individual participates in the competition. And you have a morning round where you'll get to judge five classes, one beef, one pork, one lamb, one beef cuts, and one pork cuts class. And you evaluate those for muscling and quality and how fat and trim they are.
Wait, can I quickly ask, when you evaluate by look? By touch? Like, do they have a magnifying glass? What's it look like when they're going over it?
Yeah, they're not allowed to touch any of the product. Everything has to be according to your eyesight. So if you had poor eyesight, you probably wouldn't do very good. And so then there's no magnifying glass either. It's pretty much you're looking at the meat and you're looking at how high the quality is, how much marbling it has, that fat that's within the muscle that makes it taste so tender and juicy and flavorful that consumers really like. After that, we rank them on, so after we look at the quality, then the second most important factor is the trimness, because people don't like eating a lot of fat. And so those ones that would be ranked first would be the ones that had the most marbling, so it'd be very tender, juicy, and flavorful, but it didn't have too much fat, because too much fat is detrimental to our healthfulness. And so it's the combination of the two is what a student is looking for in their evaluation. And so there's four exhibits in a class. So, for example, there's four beef carcasses, and you have to rank them from best to worst, one, two, three, four. There would be four hams in a hams class, four short loins, four T-bone steaks, four ribeye steaks. And there would be four pork carcasses, four hams, and four lamb carcasses.
And are you guys, like, in a refrigerator? Like, I imagine you can't just wheel out a bunch of carcasses into, like, the gymnasium. Or maybe you can. I don't know.
We need to stay within the food safety guidelines. So, yes, it is cold. It is in a refrigerated environment that cannot exceed 50 degrees Fahrenheit. According to USDA regulations, we like to keep it below 45. Usually there's quite a bit of air movement. And so, yeah, it can be kind of chilly, so to speak, you know, for a kid. And that's a nice thing about it is the climate's always the same. The coldest I've ever been is in livestock judging and horse judging, because it was outdoors and I don't have any control over the wind or the rain or the snow outdoors. But indoors, the coolers are pretty much all the same, so a student can wear the number of layers that they need to be able to stay warm for the entire period and time and duration of the contest. So a contest lasts about 7.5 hours. It starts in the morning around 6:30 a.m. and it ends about 2:30 p.m. in the afternoon. So it has quite a bit of mind struggle with it, you know, and you have to be able to focus for a long period of time.
Yeah, yeah. Like a football game is what, like 2 or 3 hours? Yeah. I mean, is it one team versus one team and you look at the meet alongside that other team and everyone's kind of got their clipboard and they're kind of hiding it? Like, where does the other team come in?
You just gave a perfect description of what happened. So we have students from multiple teams and they all are We usually have enough kids where there'll be about one or two students in a group from each school.
So it's not like
and
one-on-one. It's more like, I guess, maybe like a track. I guess I don't know how this actually works, but like a track meet where a lot of, I don't know if this is actually how track meets work, but like a lot of schools are there competing at once.
Yeah, it would be like a track meet where you have, you know, 8 or 10 or 15 schools all there competing at exactly the same time. So we have 8 different groups, and generally those group sizes would have somewhere around 10 to 15 kids per group in them, sometimes up to 20. And so you have 10 minutes to evaluate a class, and sometimes 15. So it is a timed event, and with that many people, it's pretty hectic. And so you have to really be able to see what you need to see in order to do very well. At this competition, in addition, goes on at the 4-H and FFA level. So students begin on this, you know, they can begin as early as 8 years old when they're in 4-H. And so their competitions have even larger group sizes of maybe up to 40 or 50 kids in a group. And that makes it extremely crowded, and you have 10 minutes to get everything evaluated. So it becomes quite a challenge. And to get it all done in the time period that, you know, we need to get it done.
Do you average together the ratings of everyone on your team? And then that's like your team's official guess for this meet? Or how does it work in terms of like, how does the individual guesses kind of add up to a final team score that your team wins or loses on?
That is an awesome question. And that shows the worst part of what we do as coaches. Is we have to select 4 out of our entire team before the competition, and those are the 4 scores that count. And so we have 23 students on our team, and we have to pick 4 at every contest that are the 4 scores that count for our whole entire team. And we're not very good at that. We have a hard time picking the students correctly because, as you know, I mean, I think 18 and 19-year-olds may be a little inconsistent. And they may be doing well one day and not doing well the next. And so as a result of that, we probably don't get the right 4 picked every time. But that's also part of what makes it exciting and fun.
Do the students know when they start, like, I'm the guy today or I'm the girl today?
They do not know unless we tell them, and we generally don't tell them.
Is it mixed gender like that, men and women compete?
Yes, absolutely. It's totally guys and girls, men and women competing in exactly the same competition.
So the students are trying to see how accurately they can judge the livestock. You're playing your own little game where you have to see how accurately you can judge the students and how good they're going to be at judging livestock.
Yes, that's exactly right. And we are terrible at it.
Well, not to blow up your spot, I don't want to embarrass you, but Texas Tech is pretty good at competitive meat judging from what I can gather. Is that correct?
Yes, we have been very competitive and continue to work hard to do so. We have, you know, we've had great students. We've been very blessed to have a lot of success in meat judging.
To what do you attribute that success? Like, what is it that the Texas Tech program is good at that makes them successful at meat judging?
I would say that, you know, there's a few things that we try to focus on, and it's not winning. It's really trying to be able to have some things that are important, which are excellent. So, you know, your work ethic and the students. Yes, start out with great students to start off with. I guess the fastest way not to do well is to not have very, very good, talented students. And so we're very fortunate that at Texas Tech, we're able to recruit and have some of the absolute smartest kids in the whole world on our team. Many of them are not necessarily coming to judge meats to stay in the industry. We have a lot of pre-med students who are going to go on to be medical doctors, physician's assistants, nurses, lawyers, dentists, pharmacists. And I would say, you know, 2/3 of the team are probably going to go on to a professional school like that. So they're really smart kids that just want to compete and want to be able to work at being the best. And so we have the ability to have those great kids here, and then that allows us to have more success. I think that pursuit of excellence is something that we really focus on because you can work and help yourself to become great even if you don't have much competition. The second thing is you have to do it with honor because you could win the national championship and you could be the best, but you kind of cheated or didn't do the right thing to get there, and it's really meaningless. And the third thing is to do it unselfishly. So we talk about striving for honor in the pursuit of excellence while serving unselfishly, because you can be the best, which means you're the national champion, and you can do it honorably. But if you did it all for yourself, it's meaningless. Because if you did it and you didn't bring people with you and make them better, and you didn't bring your family together, then it didn't mean a thing, because you just did it all for yourself. And the way we try to build a really good team is through trust, commitment, and love. And I think, you know, we all have to have a great trust for each other. We have to believe in each other. We have to believe in what we're doing. And then we have to be committed, which is back to the excellence equation again. If you're not willing to put in all the effort and the work to make it happen, you won't be very successful. And you'll also have disparity among the members of your family or your team, because everybody's not pulling their equal weight. And then finally, you have to be able to love each other, because it takes a lot of love to be unselfish. I tell our team members that, you know, you may not like each other. You can go ask your grandmother, your dad and mom, and other people if they love each other, and they'll say yes. But if you ask them if they like each other all the time, the answer is probably no. And if they say yes, they're probably not telling the truth. Because love means you don't have people change. You don't tell them, hey, you have to do this in order for me to be able to like you. You just accept them where they're at, and even though you may not like them, you still love them.
So how do you cultivate teamwork on the team? What does a practice look like for you guys?
We have practices usually every day, and most of those would be about 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. before they go to classes, or it would be 5 p.m. until 8 p.m. after they get out of class. So we try to make sure they academically excel, because they're very driven for grades, because they got to get into all these professional schools. And so they're pretty much working before and after, and we'll assemble, and we'll usually judge and write 3 or 4 classes and do some other parts of the contest. And an intense workout, we try to have, you know, no talking, and we really try to work to be able to focus and to be the best we can be in all we do.
Do you have, like, practice carcasses?
We do. We have a for-profit business that we started here to help support our meat judging program.
It's
called Reader Repeat. And any of your listeners that want to order the best meat on the planet is welcome to do so. You can go to our online store and we can ship it to you. And we actually ship a lot of meat all across the United States.
And what's that website?
If you go to RaiderRedMeats.com or you go to TTU Meat Science, you'll be able to find it.
Cool. I will definitely make sure to link those in the description.
Yeah, thank you.
When you are picking the 4 people whose scores will actually count, is it like, do you have like an all-star that you lean on? They're always in the mix. And like, there's some people who maybe never get to be part of the 4. Like, everyone gets to do it eventually. Like, how much does everyone get a chance to I guess, be counted at some point over the course of a season?
No. That's a good life lesson, is that, you know, people, we try to rotate and judge different people as much as we can. But there are some people who don't ever get to judge and their score count. And that's what we tell everybody, is that it's okay, because that's really true in life. You know, you are special. God made you very special. He gave you unique opportunity traits that no one else has. And everybody can't be the person that gets to be in the limelight. Some of the most valuable players we have are those that are not the superstars. They actually do more to create team unity, to create togetherness, to create the family atmosphere than the best judges. And so everybody knows that they are to work their hardest, because excellence is truly you versus yourself in relation to the talent you've been given. And that's the hardest thing to put together, Jeff, is to get us to stop looking side to left or right and front and back at everyone else as our measuring stick, and not just look at ourselves as our measuring stick. You've seen movies like Rudy and other type of movies where people overcame their lack of talent with their effort, their work, and their excellence pursuit. And I think that's one of the key things that we really use meat judging for, is to not really learn how to judge and evaluate meat. That's really irrelevant. It's about developing those life skills of teamwork, family, pursuing excellence no matter what the circumstances tell you, being able to make the right decision when nobody's around, and you can make a decision and know that you're going to get away with it, you still do the right thing. And then most of all, being unselfish and serving other people. You know, in our society right now, I think those are the traits that we have that are kind of missing. We're always kind of looking for what's out for me. as opposed to saying, what does my neighbor need and how can I make them better? And that's what we hope we're doing in meat judging, not only at Texas Tech, but throughout all of meat judging, is to try to create, you know, people who would go out and be a change agent and would be able to help, you know, build teams and build families wherever they're located.
Is there a meetup or a match? I guess I don't know what you call it. What do you call like a meet? Is it a meet? A meet meet?
It's a meat judging contest. Yeah.
Is there a meat judging contest that stands out for you in your mind as like particularly memorable? Like one where you guys like barely pulled out a win. Like there was like a dramatic finish of some kind. Is there anything like that in this sport that you could tell us about?
Absolutely. In 2009, we had a team and we were at the national championship contest. And we really thought we had lost, and we were undefeated going into that contest. And, excuse me, we had one loss. And we were expected to win, and we thought we were going to win. And we didn't do as well as we thought we needed to. And the different categories, the first page in the awards presentation is beef grading. And we did not make the top five teams in that. Second page of the program is lamb judging. We did not make the top five of the teams in that.
Wait, can I stop you for a second? I'm curious, like, when they're announcing the teams, is it like, I don't know, like when I see figure skating at the Olympics and they're, like, announcing the winners over the loudspeaker and you guys are reacting? Like, how do you get the results back?
We're sitting in a formal banquet. Everybody's dressed up.
I love it. Yeah.
Suits and ties and dresses, and it's very formal. And we have a really great sit-down dinner. It's trying to build the camaraderie of this group of people because they're all going to be the industry together.
So this is like later that evening, you're having a banquet. Are you eating the meat that you judged in the competition?
We are not, but we're eating meat that probably came from the company that is hosting us, whether it's Cargill, JBS, or Tyson. Generally, because the meat that we're judging is too fresh. In order for your meat to be the most tender, flavorful, and juicy, we need to do something that's called aging, which means most meat, for it to be the best for you to eat, is about 14 days after the animal's harvested.
Gotcha, yeah.
And so if we were to eat and consume the stuff we ate that day, it wouldn't be as good because it needs to go through that aging process. That's a good question.
Okay, so you're at the banquet. I'm sorry I interrupted you. You found out you weren't placing in the top five in the first two programs, and someone, I guess, is announcing this at the top, at like on a dais of some kind, maybe?
Yes, so the coordinator of the meat judging program that works for the American Meat Science Association is the one who calls off all the awards. And they also get the committee and the officials and have them come in and host the competition. They do all the work. They're paid staff person for the American Meat Science Association. So they call off the awards at this formal banquet. Then we get to the third part of the program, and that is beef judging. And we did do well in that. We had like four out of the top five individuals there. And then we get to one other category, and we do well. And we're all sitting at our tables, and I'm going, I think we got third. And everybody goes, no, I think we're fifth. And they keep calling everybody off, and the next thing you know, we end up winning that contest. And that was the biggest miracle ever. It was like a miracle on ice, 1980 hockey team. And we were just completely floored. And, I mean, I have to tell you that that was a miracle. I mean, there's no doubt that that was a miracle. And we, you know, we give God all the credit for that. That's a memorable win, and it's one that will always be there. One of the guys that we emulate a lot in the program that I tuned into early on, I don't know if you've ever seen or looked at Lou Holtz. But Lou is a guy that put out a lot of motivational videos and was an inspirational speaker and did a lot for businesses. And so, you know, I've robbed a lot of things out of him, you know, the trust and commitment and love and all of those things. And treating other people the way you want to be treated is fundamental in any kind of family or any type of situation. And so that's what we do our best. And we fail at it every day. The one thing I want to make sure we're transparent and real. We totally fail at excellence. We fail at, you know, honor, and we fail at unselfishness. But that's why we keep working, because every day we want to just get better at those.
When did you first start taking meat seriously to the point where you, you know, became academic about it and it became, I guess, a professional in it?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I grew up on a dairy farm in North Central Texas, just south of Fort Worth, and I came to Texas Tech and was working on a degree in animal science and judged livestock and horses. And I was through with judging and about to graduate, and there was a gentleman named Gordon Davis that called me at home at Christmas break and asked me to be on the meat judging team, and I told him no numerous times. He kept pursuing, and finally I just decided, yeah, I may as well go do it, because all I'm going to be doing is going to class, and I can get some more out of it, get some more experience. And so that's when I started, and ended up being asked to coach the meat judging team and go to graduate school here.
You were recruited.
Yes.
Like, did they see you like eating a steak at a restaurant and they were like, "Who is this guy? He's got real talent."
Yeah, I was on. I don't know. Maybe they were just desperate and shorthanded too. I think that we were. It's just really one of those things that was meant to be. I see it as, sort of one of those things where it's a life changer, and I feel like that hopefully we have had the opportunity to change and help people to grow, to go out into society and do the things that, they're going to need to do wherever they're at. Some of our most valuable, in my opinion, players, if you look at alumni, are people who are folks that stay at home and take care of their family and have a huge impact in their community and their family. And so anyway, I went to Texas A&M after I finished here, and we worked on a PhD and got that, and then went to the University of Georgia. That was my first job, and go Bulldogs. Had a great time there. The people were awesome. And then I was called to go to work in the industry, and so I went to Colorado, and at that time it was called Munford. It's the world's largest meat company, and I worked there in charge of food safety and quality assurance and training for total quality management and research and development. And then Texas Tech called and asked me to come back here because Gordon Davis left here and started a business called CEV Multimedia. And so I came back here and been here ever since, and I've probably lived the dream. People ask me, when are you going to quit? When are you going to retire? And I said, well, I guess the problem is I haven't ever worked a day in my life because I've been working with the absolute best kids that anybody could ever work with, and that's not work, And so we're really thankful for that. And that's how I got started, is through judging and growing up through that. But right now, a lot of our kids, majority of them, are not farm kids or ag background kids. They come from the inner cities, from large metropolitan areas. And so that's really cool because we're able to see all of these kids. They have no background in it, and they come in and they get really excited about it and go into the industry, and they're working every day, making hot dogs or healthier snack meat items. I mean, some of the things that these kids are doing are amazing. The whole healthfulness craze we have right now, and pursuing going down the path of protein and doing more to get skinnier and eating less carbohydrates. We have a lot of our students that are working on developing those snacks that you are seeing and going to see readily available to you. And it's really, really pretty neat. If you've ever seen or eaten a Lunchable, maybe you have.
Sure.
Hopefully some of your listeners have. That was invented by a Texas Tech meat judging team member that went to work for
Oh,
Oscar Mayer,
cool.
straight out of here. And then Slim Jims and those early protein snack sticks were also a Texas Tech meat science person. So that's what those kids do. And I mean, those are some of the examples of the things they do.
Are th what's happening right now? What's new in meat science right now that's got you excited?
Well, we have some of the very best ready-to-eat, shelf-stable snack meats that are coming that are really tender, juicy, and flavorful, and they're shelf-stable. So they're high moisture, which is really unique, not like jerky, which is very dry and tough. And the chicken and the pork and the beef in those are just amazing. And so it's a brand new technology that has an emulsion, which means that we're able to, if you have like mayonnaise or salad dressings or things like that, those are emulsions. And it's basically suspending the fat and water. And so we have those, and we're putting it into the meat, all natural ingredients, nothing that's artificial. And it gives you something you can put in your backpack, you can put in your purse, you can let your kids take it to school, and they can have a really high energy, high protein snack, instead of something that is a lot of carbohydrates. It's low in fat, only about 1 to 2% fat, very high in protein and energy. And the cool thing about it is, you know, that half of women in the United States are iron deficient because they don't eat enough red meat. And so from a standpoint of getting a 3-ounce portion or a 2-ounce portion of beef three or four times a day in order to get those iron levels up, it's a perfect snack for that. So I don't know if you've ever seen or bought some string cheese.
Sure.
So that's the concept, is to try to put these into individual packages. They could be in a master bag, and you just take and throw a couple in. And, you know, you can combine that out there when you're on the go and be able to pull it out. And the neat thing about it is, when you eat carbohydrates, you're usually hungry again in a couple of hours or in half hour, 45 minutes. When you eat something that's really dense in nutrients, like these snacks that we're talking about that are chicken, pork, and beef, you get a lot of long-lasting calories that you really aren't hungry again, and it cuts down your total consumption of calories in a day, which is helping people to lose a lot of weight and become more healthy. I mean, there's not such things as healthy foods. It's really all food is good. It's just managing to get the foods invested in the right calories that don't tend to make you hungry again, so you continue to eat. I don't know if you're like me, but if I sit around and snack on things that are high in carbs, I tend to just keep eating them because I keep getting hungry.
Right. I don't know if this is your bag, but I have to ask, have you tried some of the new, like, meat, high technology science kind of meat alternatives? It seems like there's, like, a lot of development there, and it's literally not meat, so it's not meat science, but it seems adjacent to your world. So I'm wondering if that's something you think about, have tried.
Oh, yes. We work on those. We try to develop all, you know, vegetable snacks for people that would like that. And, you know, I think that the one thing we always feel like is important is that we give the consumer what they want. The consumer will determine what they want by what they purchase. And so it's our job in the food and meat industry to produce whatever it is that they want. And, you know, the advantages that we have to understand is everybody wants natural. Well, you really can get the best, most nutrient dense micronutrients from natural foods, which would be meat. So, for example, all the B complex vitamins, and especially iron, phosphorus, and zinc and magnesium, are not readily bioavailable. That means that you can eat all the green leafy vegetables you want. You can supplement them with all the supplements you want, but they don't absorb. And so they just bypass out into the environment. And so we have done studies in Africa where you have severe malnutrition, especially iron deficiencies. And just by feeding, we had children who were literally on the brink of death. They were swollen and distended. We had mothers who were really very, very low. They had hemoglobin levels around 5, and you get a blood transfusion at 7. And we just put them on a simple diet of 5 ounces of bone-in goat meat for 5 days a week. And in 6 weeks, they were up running and moving, and they learned so much better in the classroom. And the mothers could walk and travel and gather for their families about 3 miles longer every day. And so those are the things that I think are really good, is the protein we get out of those plant meat snack items, meat substitutes, Beyond Burger, and all of those is great. So protein is one component, but the micronutrients is where we really suffer. Does that make sense?
It does.
And so that's why I think that meat is part of a real healthy diet, as well as vegetables. Like, a really good example of that is if you look at our food recommendation guideline now, it's back to being a plate. It was always round and pretty much divided in equal portions all the way up to 1990. And then in 1990, they came out with a food pyramid, which is a fattening ration for Americans, for humans. And it's the same thing we feed a pig to make them fat. And so we became very obese over the next 20 years, a lot of diabetes. And then, I guess about 3 years ago, we went back to the dietary guidelines that we had before, which is a balance of eating all the food groups and doing everything in balance and moderation. And so that's why I think that those snacks that you talked about, those Beyond Burgers and all that, those are all great. We need to produce those for however many people want to eat them, but they're not as good for you and nutrient dense as eating meat. And so both are really good, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's just your choice. And I think the consumer should always get to choose.
something people talk about a lot with meat production is the environmental impact. Is that something you think about when, I don't know, when you study meat?
Oh, yes, absolutely. We are researching that right now. And the whole industry is. And so we've reduced the environmental impact of the production of beef cattle and dairy. Dairy is the carbon footprint is reduced by around 65% in the last 50 years. So the impact on the environment of the dairy industry has been reduced from a carbon footprint by about 65%. The beef industry is producing more beef today with basically 40 million less cows than it had in 1970. So again, in 50 years, we have reduced the carbon footprint of the beef industry and the dairy industry over 50%, and that's a big drive. Also, the utilization of water is very important, and we are working with our major industry partners to look and investigate how to save more water every day. And then the use of corn plants, soybean plants, and a lot of feed-producing plants for livestock. Also, we have been able to give those a genetic modification to be able to increase the yields. And I know that's probably something else that your listeners are always interested in, or what we call GMOs. Would you think that those are always kind of intriguing for people?
Yeah. Good or bad, GMOs, what do you think?
Well, I think that they're, so far, they have proven to be very good. And I think we should be able to have both for consumers to choose from. The thing about genetic modifications is those are the same things that are allowing us to make all the breakthroughs in the medical industry. The genetic GMOs that we have is what's helped us to get by AIDS. So we pretty much kept AIDS from killing people through GMOs. We've done the same thing through cancer therapies. We've been able to take the cells from those cancers and be able to take their DNA and genetically modify them and put those cells into a therapy where it goes in and stops the replication and pretty much arrests the cancer in the body of a person. And so those are all genetic modifications that we use every day to save thousands of lives in the field of cancer and heart research. We also use that same technology over in the agricultural field to be able to have higher yields, because instead of using pesticides, we can use a genetic modification in the corn plant that does not allow the cornworm to eat the plant. So we don't have to use those pesticides against the cornworm anymore. When the cornworm eats the corn with that in there, it stops its replication, so we don't get more cornworms, if that makes sense. And those have been very, very effective in being able to decrease the amount of food cost and allow us to feed more people worldwide. So that's the positives of GMOs. I don't really have a negative that I can think of that in the science has ever proven that we've had Frankenfood or people have developed anything from that. And we've had GMOs around for a few hundred years, ever since Mendel started crossbreeding plants. You know, many of the plants that people put in their gardens and in the flower gardens are genetically modified because we've crossbred them. And so I think it's more of education and understanding than it is good or bad. I don't think that any of it is bad. You know, I think that the key thing is we did away with a lot of hunger, and we did away with a lot of starvation in this country and around the world by being able to increase our production through the genetic modification of different plants. And what's really cool is that we have the projection that the number of people on this planet are going to double by the year 2050. And so we're going to have twice the food we need today. And if we keep shrinking the amount of ground because we keep building houses on it for ourselves, we have to do it through whatever science and technology allows us to do to be able to produce the more corn, the more wheat. And, you know, now we're getting to produce gluten. You know, we're getting the gluten-free out of a lot of our grain products as well through genetic modifications, which is going to help a lot of people who have gluten intolerance.
Right. Well, I love that you've taken this science and this trade and turned it not only into a game, but like a game that has this positive, I don't know, these positive elements where like kids are learning teamwork and honor and all that, but also while they're learning a professional skill and about science. And it sounds like the field of study is like really still, I mean, meat is like, it's like literally one of the oldest human products, right? But it's like cool and interesting that you guys are still able to find new ways to improve, I guess, human society, right? Through science and meat. Is that all sound correct?
That is very true. I mean, that's exactly it. The meat judging team is simply a recruiting tool to get kids in to be able to solve the problems that are environmental impacts, genetic modified impacts, food safety, meat safety, you know, bacteria, keeping it out of people's kitchens so they don't ever get sick, and nutrition, you know, trying to make people healthier. And so people will go out and try to compete to beat Oklahoma or, you know, Ohio State, and we can get kids really excited about that and go do that. And the outcome of that is they develop a passion to help other people and to be able to try to create things that are more healthy and will make people live longer and higher quality of lives. And so that's why, you know, for me, it's very important to really talk about and discuss the fun things in meat judging, but relate it over to how we can actually impact people's lives through nutrition and safety and all these things we talked about.
Let me ask you one last question. Do you think that, I mean, could any trait, obviously there's other fields of study that improve human condition, like, but as far as I know, there's no like sort of medical equivalent of what you're talking about, or even like a plumbing equivalent of what you're talking about. Like, could you kind of take any trade or any field of study, and do you think apply this competition framework as a way of getting people interested and training them? Like, do you think that would work for other things besides meat?
Oh, I think so, and I think we see it in reality shows all the time.
Right, of course, sure, yeah.
People get excited and they do that. And so I think that everybody most everybody likes to compete.
But there's no meat judging reality show, as far as I'm aware.
There's not yet. We have a reality show every time we have a contest.
You know, the big pop culture spotlight for meat judging, as far as I know, is King of the Hill. The very last episode of King of the Hill is about meat judging. And like, it's kind of this common ground that Bobby and Hank, who, you know, their father and son, they often don't have a lot in common, but the one area they both share this passion for is meat judging, and Bobby becomes great at meat judging, which is great for Hank because he always wanted his son to be competitive. Are you familiar? Do you have any idea what I'm talking about right now?
I do. We show that to our students. We host judging camps with kids all over the nation here, and we show that episode to them, and it's absolutely a great opportunity for us to get them excited about meat science and meat judging.
How is that episode in terms of verisimilitude? Like, is it accurate?
Yeah, it's very accurate, you know, and I think they did a good job of doing their background where those decisions are that important. I mean, there's that much competition going on, and so, and the hard bone and all of that, that's deadly accurate, where we have to determine the maturity of the animal from the carcass.
I love it.
And it's a big penalty if you don't do it. And you know, I think that's also the end of the day, the camaraderie and, you know, the community and what we saw depicted there is pretty important. And that's a great example of what we are doing in meat science, because we do it globally. We have students that come here and judge meat from Guatemala, Nicaragua, Ecuador, Honduras, all over Latin America. And we train them. They come here for an internship, and we have students from Australia that do the same thing. So meat judging is bigger than just the United States. It's global. And it's an awesome way to recruit the best kids into the talent of the industry. And frankly, that's what we need, because animal welfare is very important. We feel like that we have conquered animal welfare in the meat industry. If there's an animal that gets abused, that's an individual case, just like a person. We can't say everybody is a child abuser, right? It's an individual person that can make that happen, because we have strict guidelines that we've implemented throughout our entire industry. And that's what we work on, is animal welfare and environmental impacts and healthfulness and safety and nutrition. I mean, that's basically what our kids do. And that's why when people ask, what do you do in meat judging? I said, we save lives. And then, you know, it's because we're doing all of these things, which really do have a big impact on people's quality of life and longevity.
Well, Mark, I learned a lot about meat judging this afternoon. I hope the listeners did too. Thanks so much for teaching us about it. Very interesting.
thank you so much for the time. I love being able to talk with you about it, Jeff.
You can feel it.
I
you can feel that
you
this
greatly
is a treat
for having me on.
Yeah, the idea, like, I can feel that you love talking about it, and that this. I hope I'm right in this assumption. This feels like it was not a chore for you at all. Like, I can feel your joy just sharing this information. So, again, thank you.
All right, have a blessed day, and thanks again.
That was a HeadGum podcast.